From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Margot Adler, sitting in for Terry Gross. Physicist Andrei Sakharov was one of the most revered men in Russia. Though he developed the Soviet H-bomb, he later stood up to the state on nuclear responsibility and human rights. And in 1975, he won the Nobel Peace Prize. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with his biographer, Richard Lorre. Lorre also translated Sakharov's memoirs. Also, a 6-year-old white girl, an 80-year-old black woman, and a racist Afrikaner are just three of 26 characters in the one-woman show The Syringa Tree, set in apartheid South Africa. We talk with the woman who wrote and performed the play, Pamela Geen. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. President Bush said today he expects Israel to complete its pullout of the West Bank peacefully. Mr. Bush said he tried to reassure Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Abdullah today when the two men met at the president's ranch in Crawford, Texas.
I made it clear to him that I expected Israel to withdraw, just like I've made it clear to Israel, and we expect them to be finished.
Aides to Prince Abdullah say the Saudi leader was bluntly critical of the president for his handling of the latest Middle East violence. He reportedly told Mr. Bush the U.S. must, quote, rein in Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. United Nations officials are meeting with an Israeli delegation on the nature of a U.N. fact-finding mission to the Jenin refugee camp. Earlier, they'd agreed to an Israeli request to increase the number of military experts on the team. Linda Fasulo reports from the U.N.
Three Israeli government officials from the defense and foreign ministries are in New York to make Israel's case regarding the UN fact-finding team. They are meeting with UN political and legal officials, and UN Secretary General Kofi Annan is slated to participate only if needed. Israel says it wants to ensure that the team includes enough military and terrorism experts. Israel claims the camp was a center of terrorist activities. UN spokesman Fred Eckhart expressed hope that the talks would resolve any concerns Israel may have about the mandate and the team. He did not know how long the meetings would last. Earlier today, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan spoke with Israel's foreign minister Shimon Peres about the mission. For NPR News, I'm Linda Fasulo at the United Nations.
A federal judge has said he's prepared to rule the federal death penalty unconstitutional. Judge Jed Rakoff wrote in an order that the system is likely to execute innocent people, which is a violation of constitutional safeguards. NPR's Barbara Bradley reports.
It's a routine case. Two men are charged with killing an informant as part of a narcotics operation, and federal prosecutors are seeking the death penalty. But in an order, Judge Rakoff asked the government to justify bringing death penalty charges. He said that technology like DNA has resulted in many people being exonerated and released. He said if the court sanctions execution, quote, the probable result will be the state-sponsored death of a meaningful number of people, and that would violate their constitutional rights. Rakoff is believed to be the first federal judge to threaten a frontal assault on the constitutionality of the federal death penalty. So far, the courts have nibbled at the edges, ruling that it's unconstitutional to execute a minor, for example, or someone who's mentally retarded. Barbara Bradley, NPR News, Washington.
The main stock indexes remained largely unchanged today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 5 points at 1035. The Nasdaq was up less than a point. The S&P 500 was down less than two. This is NPR News. An explosion in the Chelsea section of New York City sent pedestrians and workers running this morning and blew out windows up and down the block. More than 40 people were injured in the blast. From member station WBGO, Terry Sheridan has this report.
Officials say the cause of the explosion at the 10-story commercial building might have been the result of an industrial accident. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg says the explosion occurred in the basement facility of Valtech Sign Painters, which had received a chemical delivery yesterday.
The thing that I want to assure everybody is there's absolutely no reason to think that this is anything other than a tragic accident.
The injured were taken to four area hospitals. The fire department says that while there's structural damage to the building, it's not in danger of collapse, and they're also looking into the potential of ongoing boiler work as a cause. For NPR News, I'm Terry Sheridan in New York.
An Enron board member was reelected to the board of Lockheed Martin Corporation today over the objections of labor groups and a group of shareholders. At the company's annual meeting, shareholders voted to reappoint Frank Savage to another one-year term. Earlier this month, an influential proxy advisor recommended shareholders vote against Savage's reelection, saying he had failed as a member of Enron's board. The International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers urged its members to vote against Savage. The union says it owns 5% of Lockheed's stock. The Labor Department says pay increases were relatively small in the first quarter of this year. The government's employment cost index rose by just 0.8%. The index is a broad measure of changes in workers' compensation. The first quarter pay increase was the smallest since the first quarter of 1999. I'm Frank Stacio, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at www.fordfound.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Margot Adler, sitting in for Terry Gross. A poll taken in Russia not long ago posed this question. Who are the three most important people who have defined Russia in the 20th century? The answer came back Lenin, Stalin, and the third person was Andrei Sakharov, the winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, the developer of the Soviet hydrogen bomb, who, along with his second wife, Elena Bonner, became a tireless fighter for human rights. Before the downfall of the Soviet Union, Sakharov was exiled to Gorky, went on three debilitating hunger strikes, and was forced to rewrite his memoirs from scratch several times after his manuscripts were stolen by the KGB. My guest today is Richard Lorre, who has written a new biography of Andrei Sakharov. Lorre wrestles with the complex question of Sakharov's transformation from a scientist accepted into the highest Soviet circles to a dissident whose view of the world had completely changed. Sakharov started, of course, as a scientist, and when one thinks of a scientist, particularly one enthralled by theory, by quantum physics, string theory, the nature of thermonuclear reactions, one doesn't normally think of an activist fighting for human rights. And Sakharov did some of his best work before he really took an interest in politics. In fact, wouldn't it be fair to say that often freedom to create in science isn't necessarily blocked by authoritarian systems, and in fact, it's sometimes the one place where people in those systems can be creative?
That is an interesting paradox. Sometimes it's true that, well, at least it was true in the Soviet Union, that the physicists, especially after Stalin realized what the potential of atomic weapons was, that is to say, after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the physicists in the Soviet Union were given rather wide latitude, and which meant, on the most practical level, they were paid a lot of money. They had access to materials, magazines, journals from the West that no other Russian could get near, and if had in his possession, would be in trouble. So they were of some use to the state, but as Stalin remarked candidly in private conversation, well, we can always shoot them later, meaning that their utility was not ever going to encroach on his authority. So they did have a certain amount of freedom, and they did amazingly creative work. I mean, it's an odd, not only the scientists, but it's some of the Russian writers did excellent work under terrible conditions. And the odd thing is that after 1991, when the Soviet Union collapsed, I, for one, expected to see a great outpouring of painting and novels and literature in general, and nothing of the sort happened, as if the dynamic of repression and counter force somehow was necessary for the Russian creative dynamic, because, as we know from in the last 10 years anyway, not a great deal has come out of there.
I wonder, when I was reading Sakharov, a biography, I was wondering about what he thought of his role as developer of the hydrogen bomb. I started thinking of that famous quote, was it Oppenheimer, you know, I am Shiva, destroyer of worlds. And how did he feel about his own role? Did he feel guilty? Did he feel proud? Was it a mixture of things? Do you have any sense of how he confronted that role?
I don't think Sakharov had a scintilla of guilt about developing the Soviet H-bomb. The Soviet Union had just been through a terrible war on its own territory. The Nazis had invaded and come to kill people. I mean, what could be worse than Nazis coming to kill you? He had seen all that. he understood perfectly well at the time that parity was the only security for his country. So he never had any great second thoughts about his work on the H-bomb. He wasn't the kind of person who would even waste emotional time feeling needless guilt. It simply wasn't in his character. When he was working on the H-bomb, he was doing it for two reasons. One, because it was so scientifically exhilarating to unleash the energy that drives the sun and the stars, which is how he put it, and because he felt it was his patriotic duty. He called himself a soldier in the new scientific war. That's pretty much an exact quote. The United States of America had used the atomic bomb twice, and by 1949 it was clear that the wartime alliance between the Soviet Union and the United States was completely over. So simply on the level of survival, the patriotism of survival, it was important to make sure that your country had parity with any other country. And at that time, Sakharov believed that his society, the Soviet society, was what he called a breakthrough society. He believed in socialism. He was, to the degree that he was aware of what went on in the West, he was appalled by its inequities of wealth, its social injustice, and its tacky mass culture.
Now, when Sakharov first began to buck up against the system, it had happened when he started arguing against nuclear testing. How did that lead him to rethink his whole worldview?
Actually, it was very interesting how this all happened. It all began with a pencil and paper. He sat down one day and figured out that every megaton tested releases a certain percentage of fallout into the atmosphere, and that it can be realistically calculated that every megaton would, over the course of time, invisibly, cause 10,000 deaths. And we all have friends who are dying from cancer at young ages now, and every time that happens to someone in my life, I have to wonder if this isn't an instance of Sakharov's prophecy coming true. Now, he made that simple calculation. One megaton equals approximately 10,000 deaths. That did not directly lead him to say testing should be ended. It led him to think that any testing that was not absolutely necessary should be ended. Now, the point was, in the Soviet Union, some tests were purely scientific. Let's blow this thing up and see what we get. But some of the tests had a definite political aspect to it. For example, when Khrushchev had decided to renew the attack on Stalinism at a major party conference, the 22nd, he wanted what Sakharov called a big bomb to be exploded on that very day to lend the sort of thunderous authority to his voice. It was a purely political test. And it was that kind of test and other similar tests that Sakharov initially opposed. And so you could say that his road to dissidence and his road to human rights began with two things. One was the pencil and paper he used to figure out that each megaton tested will cause 10,000 deaths, and his willingness to stand up to Khrushchev and say unnecessary tests should not be conducted.
But this transformation, it seems to me, when I look at it, it seems quite incredible. Here is a man who is doing science in an installation that apparently was designed or was certainly built by slave labor, correct? And he even
correct.
Says that he saw prisoners walking around and really never thought about them. So how did that consciousness change? How did someone change to someone who thought primarily about philosophy and science to someone who suddenly was in the forefront of the battle for human rights?
Sakharov always believed in evolution rather than revolution. He saw in nature and in society that the best path for change was slow, incremental alterations. And I would say that more or less describes the inward transformation that he went through. It was a gradual, daily awakening to the reality of life around him, which came through thinking, which came through reading, which came through contact with other people. And he began to actively look into the crimes of the Stalinist past, the successes of the American economy, the problems of the world in other places, population, ecological problems. He began to give real thought and real time to all the big questions of the era. And by 1968, he had written his book Peace Progress and Intellectual Freedom, which was published in its entirety by the New York Times. It was about a 70 or 80-page essay, which is one of the few books that the Times have ever published in its entirety because it was of such great importance. So anyway, sometime between the death of Stalin in 1953, which Sakharov genuinely mourned, and the summer of 1968, he had created for himself a complete worldview, which was never fixed and never inflexible, but now he had his own standpoint to view his country and the world, and on that basis to take action, some of which were very personally costly to him. For example, allowing the publication of that essay in the New York Times and abroad outside of the Soviet Union immediately cost him his job at the installation, and he was never to set foot there again except to go and clean out his desk.
My guest is Richard Lorre. His new book is Sakharov, A Biography. We'll talk more with him after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is author Richard Lorre. His new book is Sakharov, A Biography. Richard Lorre is also a producer of television and film documentaries and other books, including Russia Speaks and Hunting the Devil. In 1956, Nikita Khrushchev gave his historic and, at that time, astounding speech to the 20th Congress of the Communist Party, revealing the brutality of Stalin's purges. This event had incredible reverberations in Russia and all over the world, certainly among communists all over the world, including in the United States. Isn't it hard for people today under 50 to comprehend the impact of that speech?
I mean, I don't know if this is a useful analogy, but in a certain sense, some of the turmoil that the Catholic Church is going through these days, if the Pope himself turned out to be a child molester, that would send a shockwave through the Catholic community of the world that would be similar, I would imagine, to the shockwave that passed through the socialist community of the world when the full extent of Stalin's crimes was revealed by Khrushchev. Not that the full extent, but
certainly a lot.
But certainly a great deal of what Stalin had actually been about was revealed by Khrushchev in 1956.
One of the most amazing stories that you tell in Sakharov, A Biography, is about the tenacity that Sakharov had in writing his biography over and over, his autobiography, I guess, his memoir, as the KGB stole those writings when he was in Gorky, and he would begin again and again and again. Tell that story.
The KGB stole Sakharov's autobiography in manuscript from him twice, the first time by tricking him in a dentist's office and leaving his bag, which he always kept with him because he was aware they were wanting to steal it. And then again by smashing the glass of his car, spraying his face with a aerosol narcotic, and grabbing the same bag which he had the manuscript in it for the second time. Now, that was a manuscript of something like 800-900 typed and handwritten pages. He was suicidally depressed each time after the manuscript was stolen from him, but once he got through that suicidal depression, he simply sat down and started from scratch and wrote the 1,000 pages all over again. He simply was not about to be defeated by the KGB.
Let's talk for a moment about his second wife, Elena Bonner. She's a Jewish woman. She's still alive. She was attacked by many in the Soviet Union as kind of the evil genius behind this man who swayed this pure scientist into politics. What do you see as the truth of their relationship, and how influential was she on him?
Well, actually, what Elena Bonner says about Andrei Sakharov is actually what I just said from a different point of view, that once Andrei Sakharov had made up his mind no force in the world could dissuade him. And even though Elena Bonner is a considerable force as a person, she had no power to dissuade him once he had set his course. Bonner likes to tell the story of there was an explosion in the Moscow subway, which the KGB blamed on Armenian terrorists. I think that was in the early 70s. And Sakharov had a very strong sense that it was, in fact, it was the whole thing was a KGB charade. I mean, it actually happened, but it was the KGB who did it for their own purposes. And Bonner absolutely told him not to say that publicly. The KGB would never forget or forgive such a statement. And, of course, Sakharov, after thinking it through, went ahead and did exactly that. And Bonner was right. The KGB never forgot or forgave that incident. And when they got the chance, punished him severely. But it is a good example of the fact that if Sakharov made up his mind to do something, neither the KGB nor Elena Bonner nor anything else on earth could sway him.
What was exile in Gorky like? What did that life seem like, look like, feel like?
I think the essence of the exile in Gorky was isolation. I think the attempt was to give Sakharov the outward trappings of a reasonable life. Gorky is a nice city. It's not deep in Siberia. It's a city with a kind of European old town heart. It has movie theaters. It has art galleries. It has a little something. But no one could approach Sakharov on the street. No one could communicate with Sakharov without official permission. And neither could Sakharov communicate with anyone without official permission. So I think it was, and of course the apartment was completely bugged, so you had always had that sense of you could be sitting in your living room with your wife, but knowing that every sigh and whisper was being listened to, probably live, not even recorded, but live. So it was a very 1984-ish experience, outwardly not bad. You had a reasonable apartment in a nice city, and yet you're in a kind of super space age plastic bubble of isolation where nothing can reach you and you can't reach anyone. On the other hand, Sakharov was a realist and Bonner was too, and they made the best of it. He did some good scientific work there. He wrote his memoirs there. They had a lot of time to be together, which they enjoyed greatly, because back in Moscow previously, there had been so many activities going on constantly, so many causes, trials, arrests, that they never had time for each other. So, ironically, I call that chapter The Blessings of Exile in the book, because there were some blessings to it.
Now, after Gorbachev comes to power, he suddenly has his freedom, and he travels to the United States, he travels elsewhere. How would you describe the last period of his life?
The last 3 years of his life, in a sense, well, he went from being enemy of the people to a people's deputy. He was officially elected. So he became directly involved in the shaping of Soviet politics at that time. He was able to leave the country. He always considered the right to leave one's country to be a fundamental human right, the right to leave and return. If you can't do that, then essentially you're a prisoner in your own country. Which he, like nearly every other Soviet, was. In all his years, he had never set foot outside of the Soviet Union until he was in his 60s. He simply had never been allowed abroad for various reasons. Once he was too valuable as a scientist, later because he was too dangerous as a dissident. I think those were years of immense work, sweet satisfaction, a great enjoyment of the world, which he had thought about so much but had never been allowed to see. He met everybody from Maggie Thatcher to Daniel Ellsberg, traveled every place he could go, and worked absolutely tirelessly to direct what was being called then glasnost and perestroika towards a reshaping of his country that he had always dreamt of himself. He always felt that the only solution to world problems was convergence, that the Soviet Union and the United States had to become more like each other so that the differences between them could not lead to nuclear war. And now he had a chance to actually see and shape that in action.
How would you assess his innovations as a scientist? What in fact did he create?
Sakharov's principal contributions, interestingly, come at the opposite extremes of science. He made important discoveries and posited, I would say more posited, important and useful theories in particle physics and in cosmology. That is to say, he was interested in both the very smallest and the very greatest of scientific questions. Great American scientists like John Wheeler acknowledged that their own thinking had been greatly influenced by Sakharov's views on the nature of gravity. What is gravity? How does it work? Is it made of anything? But Sakharov also gave a great deal of thought to the origin of the universe, and one of his favorite statements was that the most beautiful thing to him in all the world was the lingering hiss of the Big Bang, which could be picked up as background radiation noise, that we could still hear the creation of the universe with subtle enough scientific instruments was for him a source of tremendous pleasure. And he was the sort of scientist, a little bit like Einstein in this sense, but only a little bit, who by gazing or contemplating constantly the magnitude, the intricacy, the beauty of the universe, came essentially to a position that was almost religious, in the sense that Sakharov at the end of his days had to believe that there was more to the universe than we could ever know, and that there was something behind it all or within it all that was, I think he used the word warm, meaning that the universe is ultimately not cold, that there's something warm and alive in the very particles of existence, in the very nature of things.
Richard Lorre is the author of Sakharov, A Biography. His other books include The Autobiography of Joseph Stalin and Russia Speaks. Yesterday, Republican Congressman Chris Smith and Democratic Congressman Barney Frank introduced a joint resolution in Congress to grant posthumous honorary citizenship to Andrei Sakharov. I'm Margo Adler, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. Also sponsored in part by Nonesuch Records, now featuring Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, the new album by Wilco, available at Barnes & Noble music locations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, one woman, 26 characters. We meet Pamela Geen, actor and writer of The Syringa Tree, the new off-Broadway production set in apartheid South Africa.
Nabonga bantu uzokhula nini.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Margot Adler. Playwright and actor Pamela Geen grew up in South Africa during apartheid and during the turbulent years before the end of white South African rule. She has written a powerful play called The Syringa Tree, which tells the story of a white family and a black family whose emotional lives are intertwined. Much of the story is told in the voice of a young girl, Elizabeth, based in large part on Pamela Geen's own childhood. Geen plays 26 different characters in The Syringa Tree, young and old, black and white. A film version of the play will air on the Trio cable channel on May 6th. The idea for The Syringa Tree arose unexpectedly during an acting class taught by Larry Moss in L.A. In the class, Geen was given an exercise. Turn to the person next to you and tell them a story. Don't censor yourself. Suddenly, a memory, long repressed, rose up unbidden. Geen started talking about a formative event, a terrible night in 1967 that became the seed for The Syringa Tree.
It took place on the farm of my grandparents, which was up in the northern Transvaal. And it was an attack on the farm. It was something that was so unprecedented at that time, and sadly something that has become, you know, an everyday occurrence now in Zimbabwe and other places in South Africa. But we believe that it was what they refer to as a terrorist who came across the border from Rhodesia, then called Rhodesia, at night time and just walked into the farmhouse and attacked my grandparents. My grandfather was 82 years old at the time and really an extraordinary man. I think in retrospect now as an adult, I look back and see that he was a tremendous humanitarian and a very kind person who, despite the laws of the time, allowed black families to live on his farm. And, you know, the memories I have of that place were so idyllic that I think when this happened, it was such an extraordinary shock and certainly such a devastating thing for my mother. It was my mother's father that we moved on. We did not speak about it. The farm was called Clover, and Clover was lost to us forever. We never went back there and just basically got on with our lives.
And you hid this event sort of was sort of hidden in your own being, I guess. And then you then began to write. You then began to develop the play over 4 years, as I understand it. And you have 28 characters, 24 characters. How many characters are there? And you play them all. And who are these characters?
Well, there are, I think, 26 characters now. There were 28, and we cut some, and we added one or two, and we took them away again. But somebody said a wonderful thing to me, which was, when you watch the performance of The Syringa Tree, it's like watching somebody channel different people onto the stage or into the world, and it's almost as though you see all those different characters. And what I love about that is the idea that so many characters can live in one body. And really, in a sense, that's the message of the play, the message of tolerance and truth and, you know, how we relate to one another, and that good and evil live in our hearts and not in the color of our skin. So if all those characters can exist and come out of one body, it's a lovely idea in the end. So I'm very glad we stuck to it and we accomplished it.
When you, as Larry told it, when you morph, when you change into these characters and you go from one to another, I think it's going to be hard for people who haven't seen The Syringa Tree to sort of understand what that's actually like. Can you sort of explain what you do?
Sure. Well, I think at the beginning, you know, when we first started it, it was very, very sort of basic and, you know, going from one side to the other as you would if you were sort of standing pretending to be two different people. But I also worked with Jean-Louis Rodrigue, who was an Alexander teacher, and he and Larry worked tirelessly with me to accomplish this. And really what it is that you don't have to wait for a break between the two lines. You don't have to make a break between the two lines of two different characters speaking to one another in a conversation. You can actually use the tailing out energy of the one into the energy of the next.
So give me one example.
One example, gosh. out of the whole play. Now, what could I choose, Margot? golly, well, I could take it right from the beginning where little Elizabeth is playing up in the tree. And she comes down, and you, at this point, the audience has only seen her alone on the stage. And then she turns around to the back of the stage, and as she comes around, she's suddenly Salamina. So it's an interesting thing. There's a lot demanded of the audience in this, but I think they get it very, very quickly, and then it's part of the game of the play is, you know, being with each different character so quickly. And this is how it happens in the play.
You be quiet, eh? If you wake her up, the master, he's going to give you a big, big hiding. Come, help me to iron.
But going to Hingham, BMC Salamina, I've got my baby on my back.
Oh, very good, Miss Lizzie. Very, very good.
Dum dum. See what I learn in my school today. Scottish dancing.
Yo, Lizzie, you are jumping like a monkey.
I know. I'm hyperactive. I've had too much sugar. Buddisha, buddisha. I'm the change. Buddisha, buddisha. I'm the change. That's a ballet. Luska showed me next door. We can do the twist. And we don't even get dizzy of it. You can't do that.
Sure. Not with my big stomach, Miss Lizzie.
When is your baby going to be born, Salamina?
Very soon. The master, he say, the baby is coming very, very soon.
I will say hello to the baby. I will say to him, Dumela, Dumela.
Watching you play this role and listening to the dialogue, what I felt, particularly when watching the girl, the 6-year-old girl or 10-year-old girl or whatever, as she's in her swing, as she's talking, I felt amorphous fear. You know, there was a lot of fear that she expressed, fears that laws will be broken, fears that, that people will be taken away. Did you feel that fear growing up in South Africa? Was it palpable at the time?
I did, and I think as a child, you know, when you're surrounded by something, you don't realize that that's not the norm. You make it the norm for yourself. So I think it's only in retrospect that I realize how frightened I actually was as a child. And I'm often asked how close I am to little Elizabeth in the play. And people say to me, were you really like that as a child? And obviously I have no objective memory of what I was like as a child. I think the whole thrust of Elizabeth is about trying to take care of everybody, trying to make sure that everything is all right at every single minute, so there is no moment for her to rest. She's in charge of keeping everybody safe in her own mind. So that keeps her busy, busy, busy. And one of the things I was going to say about that is that I don't really have any objective idea of how I was, but I certainly remember how I felt, how I experienced things around me. And I think part of what contributes to that as a child is that we don't have a way to analyze or understand the events happening around us. We just experience them. We really just take them in, right into our heart, and react to them and witness what we see.
Now, your father, was he a doctor just as the father in the play is a doctor?
Yes, he was.
And was he Jewish?
My father's family were Jewish. His father was Jewish, but he married a non-Jew. So my dad was not a religious Jew, but
he's portrayed in the play as what I would call as an English Jewish progressive doctor.
And that's correct.
It made me think about the whole history of English progressive South Africans. Nadine Gordimer, but
Gordimer,
I'm also thinking
right.
of that incredible movie about the death of Ruth First, who was married to Joe Slovo, who was a Communist Party official in South Africa. And it was told from the point of view of the daughter, of a little girl. And what I remember in that movie and what I also remember in and what I think about when I think about the Syringa Tree and about that little 6-year-old, 10-year-old, whatever, girl dancing was that sense of being in an alternative world, of not being a part of the mainstream reality that is in the country and the world that you're living in, of feeling alienated in some sense from the society that you right. are growing up in? Did you feel that in some sense you were, as the slogan goes, a stranger in a strange land?
You know, I think we did in a sense, but I would also say that, you know, my family was not, my family did not feel called to be revolutionaries or working in that extreme way that they were in that film. I think they were much more just regular people trying to make sense of their lives. And one thing I think that was unusual about my family was that my father, being a doctor, he had access to a wide cross-section of the population. So he would see from the poorest black person at his consulting rooms to, you know, a white policeman who would tell stories of things that were going on in the townships that were not common knowledge or were certainly not in the daily newspapers because of the censorship of the media at the time. And then he would see boys who had come back from the border fighting in Angola and, you know, young boys sent off to defend apartheid, basically. So we would hear the stories of that at the dinner table at night, and I would see the effect that that would have on my father. And I think where he wasn't a person who went out, you know, as a revolutionary per se, and he was not somebody followed around by the secret police, I certainly did have a feeling as a child of nervousness about what was going on, and particularly some of the smaller events, like, you know, somebody phoning the police because he was seeing a black child in the white section of the consulting room. So somebody would get upset about that. And I had this fear as a child that my father would be in some sort of trouble, that some trouble was imminent. But I think a lot of that had also to do with what was going on around us politically in the country. And it was a pervasive feeling that everything was not all right, and that there was this separation, a sort of divide between the Afrikaans and the English-speaking people. But then saying that as well, I would say that there's a strange kind of intimacy in South Africa also between all of the people there, that we were designated by law to be separate from the blacks, and yet we had this intimate, close connection with them, living in our homes, taking care of us as children, really almost part of the family. And I've had so many letters from people telling me about the woman who cared for them when they were a child, and the, you know, the crossover between the different groups there.
My guest is Pamela Geen, author of The Syringa Tree, a play that is inspired by her childhood in South Africa. Geen plays all the parts in the play, from herself as a six-year-old child to a black woman in her 80s. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pamela Geen, author of The Syringa Tree, a play that's inspired by her childhood in South Africa. What is the symbolism of the syringa tree?
Oh, the syringa tree is...
Well, what kind of a tree is it, first of all?
You know, Marg, I'm always asked this question, and I keep thinking I have to go to that book and look it all up and be absolutely clear. But, you know, really I wrote it from the love I had for the syringa tree that grew in our backyard. It was an enormous tree. It's part of the lilac family, and I think it's very different than the lilac trees that we have in America, certainly, and certainly in England. The flowers are not the sort of bushy, purpley flowers that we see here on the lilac bushes and the trees, but really more like a very delicate little flower that's in a starburst cluster. And then they have green berries that turn golden. So to me, it was a magical tree always, with the golden berries, and the flowers are so fragrant. Once you've smelled that, you never forget it. So I think as a child had that as a place of refuge. And in the play, I use it as a refuge for the black people trying to hide from the police, and also a sort of a spiritual place. I think the tree, I mean, in African mythology, one of the things that I loved so much was the story of how the spirits, when they die, pass into the leaves and the trees and the berries, so that they're with us always and around us. To me, it just seemed an appropriate and really magical place, and then a special place for Elizabeth to hide, to go and think. And one of the lovely things my dad said to me after he'd read the play was, he said, "I didn't realize that little girl up in the tree saw so much." And I loved that so much because it was really the spirit of the play, in a sense.
The characters in The Syringa Tree include, of course, Elizabeth, the little girl, Salamina, mm-hmm. the girl's nanny, who cries and bellows and has this deep, deep voice full of of pain and wisdom. Elizabeth's parents, we talked about the sort of overworked doctor, and Elizabeth's mother, who I gather is sort of a woman who stays at home, a South African woman. And of course, yes. there are also some very racist Afrikaner neighbors who are very complicated. And then there is the tiny daughter of Salamina, Moliseng, who in some sense is the heart of the play, isn't it?
Yes, she is. And the lovely gift to me of The Syringa Tree was that I thought when I began to write it that it was a story about my life and about me, but it really isn't. It's a story about the children of South Africa and what they went through and what they gave to have the very basic thing that we pretty much take for granted, and that is freedom and human dignity. So once I understood that, and really it came from a profound lesson that Larry would teach me as we went along in the development of the play. And I would be so frightened to perform it. Obviously, I'm standing there by myself performing 28 characters, and I would be so nervous. And he would say to me, "It isn't about you." And I would say, "What do you mean it isn't about me?" And he'd say, "It's not about you. It's about being in service of something greater, something more important than any of us individually. And that is the idea of freedom." So little Moliseng in the play carries that message, I think. And Jason Alexander actually came to see a workshop, and he said, "You know, I love that little Moliseng. I want to hear more of her. I want to see her more." And I said, "Oh no, she's hidden. That's why she's hidden. That's why she doesn't speak, because she's illegally on that property, and that was her experience, and that was her life." And he said to me, "No, I really want to hear more." And Larry pushed me and championed me into that idea and said to me, "You have to write the thing that you're most frightened of." And I said to him, "You know, I don't feel that I have a right to speak for her. I'm not black. I'm not a child in that time growing up in her shoes. So I have no idea, and I don't feel that I can write for her." And he said to me, "If you don't speak for her and for those children who lost their lives, who will?" And once I understood that, I think I really learned a lesson as an artist that we're here to channel things into the world, to bring ideas and whatever that mysterious process is, to be of service to something greater. So Moliseng really is that for me.
Is her death in the play supposed to be the Soweto uprising of 1976?
Yes. Yes, it is. And I was a student at university at that time, and I remember this idyllic world, so-called idyllic world that we lived in, where you knew that things were wrong going on around you. You didn't feel that, you know, and I really should only speak for myself, but I certainly didn't feel that I could personally change anything other than by my own personal behavior in the world. You know, they had such military strength, and it was almost like, I think of it now almost like being, you know, when the Berlin Wall came down, that no one could believe that it actually came down. It had been there forever and ever and ever, and it seemed that it would be there forever and ever. But it came down, and this miracle happened. So at that time, when the riots began, I remember being at university, and I remember the chaos going on around me and people running from place to place and saying they're rioting in the township, and the children are burning everything. And that feeling in the pit of your stomach that you knew it would come and now it was there. I will never, ever forget that. So I try to write my idea of what they went through. And there was a child called Moliseng born at my house. And we did hide her away. And then, of course, she went off to school. And part of what I wrote as the Moliseng in the play was, what I was always haunted by with regard to that child, I always thought, Well, here we were growing up in the same house, sharing the same things, playing together. And then she went off into her life with her black skin and I stayed in mine with my white skin. And what happened to her? Where did she go? What happened to her? So I really wrote my deepest fear in the play.
My guest is Pamela Geen, the author of The Syringa Tree, a play inspired by her South African childhood. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our conversation with South African playwright and actor Pamela Geen about her play, The Syringa Tree. What was it like, Pamela, when apartheid ended for you?
Well, I think a huge sense of relief that it was over and that somehow now there might be a chance to grow South Africa into an extraordinary place. I always think of, you know, the joy I felt in coming to America, the great pride I have in feeling that I can live in a place where there's opportunity for everybody. And I remember thinking, well, now that can happen at home. Now that can be, you know, what we can work for and what we can create there.
But you didn't move back.
No, I have not moved back.
Why? And you moved to America.
Well, I moved to America, in 1980. So I've really made a new life for myself. It's been, you know, part of my journey, and I'm immensely grateful to live here. But in another way, I think of South Africa as my home. And when I speak of home, that's really what I mean. It's just been, you know, a place that I've carried with me. And I think that's why Syringa Tree came to me when it did.
But it healed the broken heart. You wrote somewhere that you had a broken heart about the place you grew up in when you came at 26 to live in America.
Yes, I did. I think I had a broken heart and didn't know that I had a broken heart until I began to write the play. I would always try to avoid conversations about South Africa and, you know, when people would ask me this or would ask me that, I would try to change the subject and or just try to get away from the conversation altogether. And I had such a feeling of discomfort and dis-ease. And I think the reason for that was I didn't know how to rationalize or make sense of it. And really, I didn't know what I felt because I'd put what I felt so far away in the back of my heart and my mind and try to run away from it. And I think I did that because it was painful to me. I didn't realize at the time that's what I was doing. I mean, I would never say that I was... there's so many people who are exiles from South Africa who left, you know, because they had done extraordinary work there and were followed around by the secret police and thrown out and deported. And, you know, I would never say that I came even close to any one of those people who I consider to be great heroes, and many of them the unsung heroes of South Africa, some in my own family. But for me, I don't know if it's my own psychological makeup or what it was. I really tried to hide it away. I tried to get as far away from it as I possibly could, and I felt profoundly ashamed of that. When I started to write the play, I realized it wasn't anger, it wasn't hatred, it was a deep, deep well of grief and love and joy that I felt that I was unable to articulate.
When did you last go back to South Africa?
I was there, I think, 8 years ago, And I'm looking forward to going back. We're invited to take the Syringa Tree to the Baxter Theatre in Cape Town. I also want to go back to Clover. I want to go, this is a very personal, I've never really spoken about it before, but I know there's nothing left there, but I'd like to go back and see it.
Is the land still possessed by your family?
No. I think it was sold pretty much after that event a long time ago, but I'd like to just go back there, really, I suppose, for the feeling of the place and the smell of the dust and the earth and, you know, just to go back and remember those early feelings.
Now, have you contacted or been in contact with the people who cared for you when you were in South Africa?
Yes, I have. And one of the lovely things that happened was we had been looking for them for quite a while. In fact, since I started writing the play, I'd asked my husband's brother, who's fairly involved in certain communities in South Africa, and he was looking, and I asked my dad, and he was looking, and I think right as I was finishing in New York, I got an email from my father to say some of the people that I was looking for were alive and that he had found them and that I could phone them. And I was absolutely, just overwhelmed with...
Did you?
Yes, I did. And I've had several extraordinary conversations. You know, and it's so funny when you drop into somebody's life like that and you've been away from them for a very long time, you have no idea where they're at and whether they would welcome you sort of imposing upon them. But I have to say the feeling that I had when I phoned was one of such tremendous joy and kindness and a welcome that I could never have imagined, really. And one of them said to me, "Oh, Pammy, I wish I had wings to fly to you." So that was that's going to be, I think, a great part of going home is going to be those reconnections and just the time and being able to spend the time again now as an adult to get to know and to look again and feel again.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Margot. I had a lovely time. Thank you.
Playwright Pamela Gein. Her play, The Syringa Tree, is running off-Broadway at Playhouse 91. A film version will air on the Trio cable channel on May 6th. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. For Terry Gross, I'm Margot Adler.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Justice Hall, a novel of suspense by Laurie R. King, author of The Beekeeper's Apprentice, available in trade paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor, director, and screenwriter Billy Bob Thornton. His film Bandits is on video, and he's currently starring in Monsters Ball. Join us for the next Fresh Air.